Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking politics. It's nice to be talking politics again, you know. And I'd like to say politics, nor as usual, but that actually, given what's happened the last few days, it's like we've gone back 10 years, Martin. What do you think?
It's exciting again. We're back to the days of Charlie and Mara.
These lads are amateurs. So Charlie got an island out of it, you know.
You could just see him picking up the bodies and sucking the meat off the bones and just dropping the skeletons. Do you know what I mean? He's just lads, he's don't know what watches are on.
Yeah, total amateurs here. But I know before we go on, we always have to get the plugs in. So it is a listener led, supported podcast. No advertisers, no editorial oversight, which we probably could do it at this stage because we fly very close to the wind sometimes, Martin. But we do need people to put their hands in their pockets to keep the project going if you think it's worth it, because we give it away for free, but we believe it has value. Head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Please do. Martin, you were in the hospital yesterday, and someone said to me, is he okay? And all I thought to myself was, maybe we'd do better in the Patreon stakes if he wasn't, though. You know? this is getting that bad, folks. Listen, enough of the misery. We're delighted to be joined via Zoom by her own, in her own words, dairy product, but recent political correspondent to the Irish Examiner, Aoife Grace Moore. Aoife Grace, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
No worries, thank you very much.
You, I suppose, what was it like when Big Dirty Fry discovered dairy and made people in the South aware that there was something up in the attic? You know, it's an unusual sort of. Journalistically, we always see even that the how it's covered, the events in the north and events down south. And I suppose now that you just started in your role just before lockdown, was it?
Yeah, just started February.
Yeah, and so you go in before February. You're coming in the midst of that. There's a general election kicking off, and then you see for the first time Sinn Féin topping the poll. Did you just look at a lot of people scratching their heads in the south and think, are you all oblivious to the rest of the island?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a generational divide. I mean, living in Dublin now and paying the rent paying, and all my friends are paying as well, it didn't really surprise me that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael couldn't get the votes together, or didn't get the votes they thought. I remember being at a canvassing with Micheál Martin during the election, and we were going around the Liberties, and he was saying, it's that famous video now that goes viral every couple of weeks where Micheál Martin said, you know, we don't want a government with Fine Gael. Fine Gael don't represent change, and we'll be looking for a government with us and the Greens and Labour and the Social Democrats. And it was the first time that I kind of thought, no, I wouldn't be great at estimates or anything like that. But I remember thinking, I don't think that that's going to work out for you. Even then, I remember thinking, I don't think Fianna Fáil are going to get enough seats that they can fall back on Labour to make up a majority.
It was funny because at the time, myself and Martin were doing nearly daily podcasts. So we started talking about it from the outset. We were really annoyed about the whole idea of just being just a two-horse race. Leo versus Micheál was really getting under our noses. And we kind of thought, actually, are the people in, and I'm going to say this in it's going to come across as derogatory, and it maybe it is from time to time, but are the people in the Leinster House bubble not aware of the level of disquiet that was actually building and waiting for them at the ballot box?
Yeah, I think it depends who you talk to. There's kind of two generations in there. There's, the older ones, they're not old, but older ones that, everyone knows, they've been there in their jobs many years and have a certain Leinster House bubble around them. And then there's a younger generation who maybe typically or even are seen a wee bit more progressive and have friends who don't own houses, who are paying rent or who live with their parents. And I think around Leinster House, and we even had bets on, like, between the journalists of, like, you all put how many seats everybody thought everyone was going to get. And if I remember right, I gave the Greens way too much. I think I gave the Greens about 18 and Sinn Féin, yeah, quite a lot as well, more than anyone else did, and then got grief for that. But, yeah, I think people knew there was going to be a change, but I don't think anyone in Leinster House realised how seismic it was going to be, because Mary Lou herself said she didn't know how seismic it was going to be. She said, and she said a number of times, the public were way ahead of us rather than the party actually knowing what they were doing.
That's true. Like, when you think about that, if the candidates, they could have run and they didn't, but, you know, look, I'm very conscious of, what was it, 145 days waiting on a government? You're just new in the job. How was it trying to cover politics in that period?
In lockdown, new to the job, being a northerner and not even 30 yet. not ideal. Leinster House, anyone will tell you, most of the stories that come out of Leinster House, the, like, real juicy stories that everyone reads, aren't from press releases. They're from bumping into people in the corridor in Leinster House and them saying, oh, did you hear this? And that's all taken away from me in lockdown. There's no one really in Leinster House. And the thing is, if politicians don't want to answer the phone, they don't have to. So if you're relying on phone calls to get to, and, like, especially for me, to get to know people, let alone get stories off them, it became a bit of an issue. But I don't know, you just play to your strengths. Like, I know that, like, older TDs who don't know me aren't going to be willing to spill their guts to me. So you just kind of have to carve out a niche for yourself. So newer TDs and younger TDs are kind of where I based myself, because I thought, well, if I don't know what I'm doing, neither do they probably. So I'll just look out for them. But it was definitely not what I thought my first couple of months were going to be. I was really looking forward to starting the job in government formation, and then lockdown happened. But like, you get through it, you just sort of have to power through. But you do go through phases of being like, I am so in over my head here. Like, just even small things, like people knowing when cabinet does and when people have their parliamentary party meetings, getting to know stuff like that is not, you don't walk into the job on the first day. Considering I've been in Leinster House around 2 years with Press Association before, but when I first started, I had never lived in the South before, and I was going to press conferences Googling what the TD looked like and what party they were in, so I'm not sure I was at the right press conference.
Well, judging by some of the ministerial appointments, I think some of that we had to Google who some of these people were as well. And that's not, you know, when they say that this is the we're political nerds. Can I just the last 10 days? You know, what sort of start do you think they've got off to? I'm going to say inauspicious, and that's being kind in my opinion.
Teething problems is the way it was said to me yesterday. They are, for a party who has historically been in government longer than they haven't, a lot of really rookie mistakes and a lot of really rusty elbows. Like, the same with the Sinn Féin Bobby Storey funeral, is these are easy mistakes that they're handing to the press. And with Micheál Martin's office, and I think Micheál was prepared, but I don't think his party or his ministers were as prepared. And you have to remember, there's a lot of, even though Fianna Fáil are historically the party of government, there's a lot of new TDs in there, and like, Norma Foley is now the education minister. She just became a TD in February. So there's been a lot of, I wouldn't say, maybe they were just stumbled out of the traps rather than took off flying. But whether they come around in the next couple of weeks is anybody's guess.
I think it's a good analogy that you used there, that they were like toddlers, because for the last 10 days or so, it's been kind of like toddlers throwing their rattles out of the prams looking for junior ministries, and now we're into the old let's get some marks under our arses stage at this point as well. It's all a bit unbecoming when you consider the position the country is in. It's like they're fighting over the sweeties and everybody else is looking at them going, are you guys mad?
It gave off a serious sense of entitlement, and I think that comes from being in Fianna Fáil, perhaps sitting while in government beforehand. A lot of the people who were complaining had been in government before, and that is kind of the main complaint that I get when I'm speaking to voters, is that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael feel like they're entitled to government and they're entitled to these ministries. And I actually seen a quote from someone, one of the TDs, his name escapes me now, but he was saying, now there's three cabinet ministers from Cork and this person is from West Cork. And he was like, oh, but we're 45 miles from Cork City. We're a different world. He's disrespected my community.
I saw it, and I know I saw an actual constituent of him said, haven't seen him in 6 years. What's he talking about? It is funny, Martin, but it's also quite worrying when you've they're talking about, you know, we're starting to see the COVID payment being, changed to cut apart for depending on what you were earning previously. And yet, Simon Coveney's like, yeah, well, I'm not Tánaiste anymore, but I want to keep the trappings of the office of Tánaiste.
Yeah, that's a strange one, though. That is a strange one. I mean, of all the TDs in there, Simon Coveney could probably most afford to get his own driver and car.
It is well known that the Coveney family fortune. They have their own investment fund.
But it's like the Soviet era. I have the biggest driver and the biggest car. That's my prestige. You know, it's really strange stuff to get hung up on. It just is strange stuff.
Can I ask one thing though about, I do want to go back to the Sinn Féin Bobby Storey funeral. I do agree. It was just, even optics were terrible. But do you think at some point, the idea of keeping it in the headlines for what must be now a week now seems to be a very strange that it's going on, or am I barking up the wrong tree?
I don't know. I mean, I'm from Derry City, which has long been, you know, Sinn Féin have a great foothold there. And when the pictures emerged in the Bobby Storey funeral, so many of my friends and relatives text me and was like, what are they doing? Like, the optics were absolutely terrible. Like, I even thought, like, again, just silly mistakes. Like, why didn't they just wear masks? Because then they could have turned around and said, yep, we knew it was going to be packed because he was a really popular figure, so we wore masks because we knew social distancing would be hard. But they didn't even wear masks. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is with Sinn Féin, they have political rivals on both sides of the border, which the other parties don't. So when something starts like this, they get it from both sides. So that's why it seems to be like this ongoing swirl of negativity around them. But like, and I've said this to a few people who work with them, like, they've nobody to blame but themselves, but they took a calculated risk. And like, anyone who knows the party knows that there was no way they weren't going to Bobby Storey's funeral, because West Belfast would have never forgiven them and they need to shore up that vote. But they just made a calculated risk, took a calculated risk and said, whatever bad press we get out of this, it'll be worth it, because at least we'll still have West Belfast. Like, I am certain that that's what happened.
And again, I have to say, I defer to your better wisdom of it, but I also think there was the idea that giving people like, oh, they stopped for selfies and stuff, that was just, you know, kicking yourself in the shins after you'd punched yourself in the face. Please stop. it shows a sort of naivety. Were you around in, you know, I saw the press corps, the outside convention center for Micheál's inauguration, I'm going to call it. Have you got a sense now that we're going to see, actually, because I didn't get much myself, are we going to see a left-right divide in the Dáil, or what's your sense of it as it's been developing over the last few days?
Yeah, I think for the first time there is going to be a real left-right divide in Irish politics. I mean, Mary Lou especially has made it really clear that she wants to work with the other progressive parties. They all seem really up for it, apart from Labour. Alan Kelly doesn't believe that Sinn Féin are a left party. I'll just leave you to decide on that.
But I'll just comment on that and say Alan Kelly has appointed himself as the leader of the opposition to the opposition. So.
But yeah, so like there will be, I think, a united opposition. I can definitely see, like, especially People For Profit and the Social Democrats, like they've both said openly that they're willing to work with Sinn Féin in opposition. And obviously, I'm sure the left had hoped the Greens would be part of that as well before the government formation happened. So I do think there is going to be, you know, a proper progressive opposition. However, because of the numbers in the Dáil, I can't see them getting that much done from the opposition benches, which was what the Greens argued was the reason for going into government, is because this opposition probably won't be able to get much done while they're there.
That's a very good point, and it's not been made enough that this is not just a cobbled together government now. It's a big majority. When you put Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Greens, and the miscreants of some of
They had a majority without the Greens.
Yeah, exactly.
So...
yeah, they all.
The Greens are a bit of a weak link in it, though, because they have said that they will walk if they don't get what they want. That sets you up for a fall. It absolutely sets you up for a fall. They're going to reach a crux point where they're going to have to walk. They're going to reach a crux point.
This is all in the never never, but I have to tell you, Martin, the same people who told the Greens for the last few months that they have to be do the big thing, the adult thing, and go into government will be the people now to say you have to be do the responsible thing and stay in government.
I know.
And already the talk of radical centrism, which is, you know, anyway, take with that what you want.
Landlordism.
Look, there's many names for it, but I would call it apologists for right wing ideology. Yeah. But nonetheless, I think it's a fantasy that they're going to walk. I genuinely do. Unless Eamon Ryan loses the leadership contest in some sort of seismic shift, I don't see them walking. I think this government will last at least four budgets. The only question I can say now is I wonder what's going to happen when, like, Fianna Fáil are now, you know, pointing at one another at the moment. They're busy killing each other over who sold out Barry Cowan. What's, you know, the next time is, what do they say when they look at their briefs and they go, well, it was like that when I got here, and can they fix housing? Can I ask, in terms of the actual government itself, someone has made the point, I think it was today, that Fiona Sheehan made the point that the former Taoiseach was leading several of the new meetings. Is the power dynamic within the coalition, you know, do you think it's going to make things awkward for them? Who's actually the boss?
And do you know what I thought as well when even government formation was happening? The real winner in government formation was Fine Gael. Like, Fine Gael lost out in the election, not by much, but they did. They've held on to, like, really important portfolios, and then gave away the ones that were giving them a hammer and in the polls. So, like, they got rid of health, they got rid of housing, gave that back to Fianna Fáil, managed to keep jobs, managed to keep foreign affairs.
Finance.
Like, so they have all these statesman-like roles. They get to keep their hands in the purse strings. And I remember thinking at the time, why are Fianna Fáil giving so much away? But I think they kind of thought if they could get health and housing, they genuinely thought if they could get health and housing, that they can turn it around. Now, health and housing isn't something you're going to be able to turn around in 4 years. Like, I think everybody, including Stephen Donnelly and Dara O'Brien, would agree with that. But they seem to, they obviously think they can do it, or they wouldn't have fought for those. They fought for education, health and housing, which arguably, you know, if you fail at these, you're going to get pummeled in the polls, because after COVID, health and housing are the two main things on people's minds anyway.
And I spoke to Dara on the pod a couple of weeks ago, and you know, he's certainly, how do I put it, he's slightly more radical than his predecessor in Noel Murphy, insofar as, you know, what he deems affordable housing to be, what he deems affordable rental to be. I just don't know if he's going to crack it in the delivery model, because it looks like they're still wedded to the private developers' delivery, and I don't think that's going to cut it for people.
For instance, like, I was speaking to a lot of the Greens during government formation, and there was one day they had been in for hours and hours talking about housing, and one of them said to me that the major issue is that they are obsessed with people owning houses, but they don't want to house people.
Mm.
And this is where the fundamental breakdown in belief between the Greens and mostly Fine Gael and DLSR sent Fianna Fáil, from what they've said to me, was that there's a big difference between building houses and housing people.
Mm.
And they are obsessed with this notion of home ownership. And the issue is, in Ireland, that's been staring us in the face for, I don't know, the last how many years, is that because the government aren't building enough social housing, we're putting people into private rental who shouldn't be there, and it's driving up the cost. But that part of it doesn't seem to be computing.
No.
Or wasn't during the talks.
And the biggest fear is of the 50,000 that they're pledging to build now. It's that, again, the delivery model looks very much like it'll be either built to rent, which is only going to be available to, you know, residential investment trusts, because they're the only people who can afford to build that scale like that. Or we actually start buying and competing with first-time buyers and competing. Like, the state will be the biggest purchaser of and long-term leaser of homes. And that is worrying, because also in the build figures they include anything that they lease at a long-term, on what they call enhanced leasing. So, if, you know, it's not even a new build, but it's included in the new build figures. You mentioned the Greens, and I'm fascinated at that, because we were all fascinated that we were all went on as if they were the kingmakers, and now it's been shown now they weren't even needed in the end, really. But how, you know, when you were talking to them, did you get a sense that there was a genuine split, or were they always going to go in?
At the start, it seemed like a genuine split. I mean, there was a few of them who were involved in negotiations who've even voted against going in. It's been said to me from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens that Catherine Martin from the get-go was there in good faith, and even though she didn't vote for it, she thought, I'll go on and we'll do this in good faith and see what we could, you know, get out of it. And as time went on, the split was always there, and I kind of think they knew the whole way through that the three that voted against it were always going to vote against it, because they just didn't feel that the other two, the lesser extent Fianna Fáil, but mostly Fine Gael, were not negotiating in good faith. And a major issue became, and I heard this from a few different people, that when they were in like a discussion session, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party had a lot of common ground. They would negotiate in good faith and they would agree on certain things. And as soon as Fine Gael dug their heels in a plenary session where things were actually getting down on a page, Fianna Fáil just crumbled and just said, well, we're not going to fight for this. And that sent a message to those TDs that, like, this is what government is going to be like for us, because Fianna Fáil might agree with us, but if Fine Gael put their foot down, we don't have a leg to stand on, because Fianna Fáil aren't going to back us up, even though they would have a bigger majority. There was this unwillingness of Fianna Fáil to really fight on certain issues. Like, I think that was like one of the most confusing things for people about the Occupied Territories Bill, which Fianna Fáil and the Greens both argued for, but Fine Gael won, and it wasn't included in the programme for government. So I think that spelled out for not only the TDs and the negotiations, but the other Green members and the wider public that this is what government is going to be like. And we've already seen from Fianna Fáil's first parliamentary party meeting last night that backbench TDs are already concerned that they have to apologise for Fine Gael policies for the last 9 years. So we're already starting to see some of these fears realised, and it's only been 10 days.
And I have to, I think you've summed it up perfectly, because that is where this is going now. It's going to the point where previous administrations would come in and say, listen, I didn't know how bad it was until I got in here. Mm-hmm. And they'll never get away with that line, because in the public's mind and in mine, they were in coalition anyway. I mean, they agreed budgets together even when they were in opposition. So, you know, how this the confidence supply agreement meant that they were in a de facto coalition. So they can't use the usual nonsense of, look, it was like that when I got here, the Bart Simpson excuse. The only other thing I'd like to ask you about is the left. You've mentioned left talking about a willingness to, you know, coalesce and talk but have you heard any rumors, any suggestions of a shared platform or anything like that?
Not as of yet, because I don't think there's a great shake for that within Sinn Féin, because just for their sheer size, that they don't really have to do that. There's a lot of chat about, you know, they'll be voting together on certain things and they'll be deciding, you know, different policies and bills. I think there'll be consultations before bills are put forward. But in terms of shared platforms and stuff, that's, it could be in the works, but it's not something they're telling us in the corridors anyway.
Martin,
what do you think of the situation up north at the moment? Is that going to impact on what's happening in Leinster House?
Has anything that happened in the north ever impacted Leinster House?
It's a good question. It's a genuinely good question. Does it impact them at all? I think no. Fianna Fáil, not so much. Fine Gael, definitely not. So, you know, I think it's going to be a rocky place for Ulster to be part of what's going on.
There's a funny thing happening, Martin. Sorry, now I'm just, sorry to come into, but there's a funny thing happening that about around the travel restrictions, you know, the 2 week quarantine and all the rest of it. And it's not been said very much, but there's a lot of people, how do I put it, middle-class people who are probably fairly well off that are agitating, saying, I want to go to my, you know, where I go, my 2 weeks in France every summer or my 3 weeks. And the real blockage to it is obviously our relationship in the common travel area with the UK. And yet, on the other hand, they're saying, oh, no, let's never talk about any sort of reunification. Actually, reunification would mean you'd get to go to your nice place in Sorrento, folks, you know. Because the EU is open since June 15th. And that's just, like, you know, Schengen is back in many forms. But I just find that the idea that I see it so often, particularly in much of our discourse, as we speak about Northern Ireland and we very much other it. We very much make it sound like it's, they're up there. And I remember the expression someone used, it's like the attic. You know, you forget it's up there and every now and then you pop the head up and you go, oh, I didn't know this was here.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to that. Like, I had never lived in the South until I moved to Dublin, but I had lived in Melbourne in Australia and played GAA with a lot of girls from the South. Mm-hmm. And that was my first real experience of learning that most people in the South don't actually know much about the North. And a lot of them were really, really interested. But this is something that happens to people from the North quite a bit. I'm sure if you stopped anyone from the North and asked them, they would say this happens to them. That, like, people, and this goes for English people and Scottish people and people from the South, you'll meet them at a pub or you'll meet them at a party and they want you to explain the troubles to them in about 5 minutes. And for me, like when I lived in Scotland and stuff, it didn't bother me as much. But especially now living in Dublin, people either have the wrong idea or don't know anything, and then they want you to explain it to them, and I have to be like, in the nicest way possible, we're on the same island, and fair enough, like, they don't learn it at school, but like, Netflix has more Northern Ireland documentaries than like most schools that are like teaching at the minute. Mm-hmm. So you do get a lot of that, and you get it in Leinster House and you get it in Toners. It doesn't matter. It's a general sense of ignorance about the North.
I think that is actually, when we talk about learning history and knowing our history, we do have a huge deficit. And it is fair to say that much of what I've learned about what's happened in the North has been in the last number of years. And it certainly wasn't learned in the first 30 years of my life. You know, it was somewhere where I went to occasionally when there was a B&Q opened and we didn't have one.
Very quickly and got home quickly.
The car weighed down with garden furniture, you know, and a few slabs of cheap drink. Just the next, I'm after saying I think the last four budgets. Do you think this is a government that was going to hang in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Eamon Ryan's told his party members as much. He said at a Dublin Bay South meeting that they had the last four budgets because it would be impossible to get anything done in the time less than that. And in the same meeting, Roger O'Gorman said they would walk away if red lines weren't being you know, implemented. So by the time Eamon Ryan said his final piece about the 4 years, the meeting was over and the Zoom call ended. And I started getting all these messages from Green members being like, they can't even get on the same page about how long we're going to be in government. Like, they had two completely conflicting messages. And then towards the end of the meeting, Eamon Ryan was like, yep, so it's going to be 5 years. Okay, that's great, everybody. See you later.
Well, I think God bless your confidence in this government going forward. Just the 2 years. Honest to God, God bless your confidence. Because there's too much going on. They can't guarantee 4 months, never mind four budgets. They just can't. And I think there's too many slips, there's too many falls to be had. It's very precarious. Things can turn very quickly.
We know things. Look how we're doing this podcast now. We know things can change very quickly, but we also look at it and go, nothing unites people like personal ambition. And if they can put aside a lot of things, especially if the guys who are disappointed now about missing out are told, hang on another 2 years and we'll rotate you in when we're rotating the Taoiseach. And, you know, sure, doesn't that help you get a part of your pension? You know, Martin, this stuff
cannot possibly see it happening. Can't see the electorate stomaching a straight swap in for Fine Gael in government. The electorate is going to say no, and it's going to say no in some way. It'll say no.
Very, very last thing for me, Aoife Grace, just in terms of the actual the role of political correspondents themselves, do you think that it's, you know, I'm conscious of the time Vincent Brown, he was talking to Lynn Ruan at the time, and I think what's Rita Martin, Dolphin's House?
Rita Fagan,
and was sitting in the audience, and he made the comment that the problem with some of the political correspondents is that they spend too much time in Leinster House. And he pointed up at Rita Fagan and he said you should be forced every month to do 2 weeks in Leinster House and 2 weeks out in Dolphin House with Rita Fagan and keep in touch with what's actually on the ground. Do you think that there's room for both in the political correspondence role?
I definitely think the old way of doing things is on the way out, because the thing is too, we're driven by what people read. And, you know, and that's never more clear when you're looking at digital analytics and where you can see in front of you what people are reading and how long they're spending on a page. And even when I got hired, you know, I went to man, this is probably the worst way to do an interview, but when I went for my interview, I told him, like, I'm not from here. I don't have family connections to any of the parties. I'm not going to get the inside scoop straight away. I also don't live in like the Leinster House bubble, and I don't particularly want to. And he said, no, like, that's why I'm hiring you, because you're a bit of an outsider, and I think that's what's needed. Because, and I think anybody in Leinster House, like around the podcast, would say to you that there is a lot of navel gazing that goes on. And we're lucky in a sense that we have, you know, a news desk who will turn around to us and say, no one cares about this. But when you're in it, I remember being at a Fine Gael thinking in Wexford, and there was 48 hours worth of scandal in this hotel, only this hotel. The Leinster bubble had moved from Leinster House, and it just sphered around this Clayton Hotel in Wexford. And when you're in it, you can't see out. And there was about 48 hours worth of scandal about whether Fine Gael members had clapped when Geoffrey Donaldson said that the Republic should join the Commonwealth. Yep. And it was like, well, are they clapped? Were they clapping for the comment? Were they clapping because he had finished talking? Then they had to find video. I had video of it because I was working from PA. I sent the video to Hugh O'Connell. It became this like sphere of like, everyone was talking about it. Everyone was like, oh God, isn't this terrible? And I walked out of the hotel and went home and had said to somebody, I actually think I said to someone in Sinn Féin, and they were like, what are you talking about? But when you're in it, because obviously if you're in a hotel with all these other poll cars and all these other TDs for like 48 hours and everyone's talking about this one thing, you think it's the most important thing in your life. You can't get away from it. So I do feel sorry for people at times, especially like the political editors, because they're in there 24/7. So it is hard to see out at times. And especially these days when, you know, you are comfortable enough to buy a house, or, you know, you have a comfortable life and you work 24/7, so you're not always going to be able to be out in, like, as we call it, the real world or whatever. But yeah, I do think people don't stand for lack of perspective anymore. So I think room is going to have to be made, and changes are going to have to be made in order for political correspondence to stay relevant, because people aren't going to read it anymore. This is the thing. Like, we're driven totally by what people read. And if people get bored of the old way of doing things, they'll have to change it.
I think people are bored of the old way of doing things. I think you're dead right on that. I think they are. I think it's time people want a different way of hearing what's going on. Thanks so much for coming on and having a chat with us this morning. And no, I am sorry that I was a couple of minutes late. My apologies.
You're grand.
My apologies for being a couple of minutes late. Just want to remind everybody that the Tour de Shack is putting out this material. We need patrons to come on board to help us keep the projects going. We do great interviews like this. So please come on board, Tour de Shack, or patreon.com/Tour de Shack. Price of a cup of coffee in there. Thanks very much.
Just like to say at the end of fair play, I like the idea of making sure people want perspective on things. Keep that vision all the way through, because it is so, so important that we get a wider diversity of voices. And, you know, people, check out Aoife Grace's work on The Examiner. You can follow her on Twitter. You'll see her work up there. Thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye.